Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for April 11th, 2024. And first of all, I want to make some comment on the amount of material that I have presented to the public on my work. It is really extensive. And so as a result, I'm not going to be putting out any more information relative to the past work that I've done. There's going to be some new groundbreaking work that's coming out that advances some of the topics, but I'm not going to reiterate or go over the past material. And here's the situation. Let me take an example. Say you're a person that has followed my work for 20 years or more, 30 years, whatever, since you first started hearing me on radio shows, or say you're a scientist who was aware of my work in 1979 and followed my publications, etc. Or say you are a person who's completely new to my work, somebody recommended you, or maybe you came through to this radio show or to my other work, the web pages, via one of the podcast platforms, for example, and you're just brand new. Who's this guy? What's he up to? And so let me talk both to professionals who would be able to understand on a different level than, say, general public. The amount of material that I've presented in the education package that I have on my webpage, I'm talking about the jmccsci.com webpage. The books, right now there's 14 books out and more on the way. There's a number of new books coming out dealing with the major topics that I've developed, prime numbers, the electrical situation in the universe, on and on. So there's some new material coming out that I'll be presenting to the public, but this total amounts to maybe about 20% of what I do. The other 80%, it's in private and I don't release it because it gets a little bit too esoteric for the public. So that work gets released in different venues, more private venues. And then there's programs that I'm working on, physical, like the development of hydrogen using wind energy with the wing generator. Those are things happening in the background that probably I'll never really release to the public. Okay, but if you today started to listen to my radio shows going back 24 years, that would take you around 3.5 years. That's one per day. Okay, and then count in the educational material. So say a book, you could read one of my books, some of the books in a day and get a basic understanding. But as when I was studying physics, for example, or mathematics, I would always read three times to begin with. And so I was always ahead of my lessons by maybe 2 weeks to a month minimum. Because I had, when I was an undergrad, had a double major, physics and mathematics. So I had, at times, five courses, advanced courses, junior, senior level. And some people who had those as a major, just one of those, might take one or two. So anyway, I was always ahead. But what I would do is I would read a chapter or a number of chapters ahead. And I would just read it quickly, just to get the verbiage down, the terminology, look at the equations, and then I'd go back and I'd read it slowly a second time to pick up an initial level of understanding. Then I went back and read it a third time, and for better understanding. And I was always drawing pictures and equating the equations to real life situations, which gave me a very good intuitive feel for how physics worked. And a lot of people didn't do that. They would just relate the mathematics to the problem and solve a problem and then go on. Well, I didn't do that. I spent a lot of extra time in understanding, and that's why I have a really good intuitive grasp and when I would attack problems in resolving problems that other people couldn't figure out, of which there are many, it's because I developed this ability to look at things from a distance. Okay, so anyway, you could potentially read some of my books in a day the first time. And it would take a second time and a third time to really pick up the information. But a book like my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, it would take a trained scientist probably 1 to 2 weeks to read it the first time and then have to go back the second time and the third time. So reading a book, it's not like reading a novel where you read it and you come to the end of the book and okay, great. You feel good, you feel sad, whatever the book was, and you probably would not read it again. Science is not like that, or like my principles of prime numbers. Most trained mathematicians have a very difficult time understanding it, let alone really projecting what it means in terms of prime numbers. So it depends on the book, or a book like Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. A little, very small book, but there again, most professionals in the field would have a difficult time reading it. But the people, say a general public person, could read that book and understand, maybe they don't understand the mathematics, but they understand the implications which are described. And all these books are written for the general public. So, and there's another 6 books coming out soon, coming out of the printing press, so to speak. Okay, so just the books, the 14 books, would take you a good period of time. Then there's the DVDs and the lecture series that, you know, you could watch it like a movie, watch it once, but you'd have to go back and forth through those a number of times to really pick up what I'm saying because they're very dense. And then you'd have to relate it back to the books. And then you have the university level course. For example, the new one that just came out, it's called Eclipsed, the New Cosmology. And basically, it's a university level or K-12 for advanced students or for the general public, but it's a college level course in cosmology, talking about the current levels of cosmology and also why it's current, you know, black holes and general relativity and Big Bang cosmology is really a joke. I mean, it's really a joke. It should have never, ever gotten off the ground. But that alone would take you a while because there are actual working problems where you take photos of galaxies and, for example, show the symmetries, measure the symmetries and do statistical calculations and create tables of symmetries talk about the level 1, level 2, level 3 symmetries and categorize them. So it takes a while, is what I'm saying. And a very good exercise for K-12 students or university students. And there's something in there for everybody. Then my education course, there's, I believe, about 180 lectures, one-hour lectures, MP3 lectures, plus associated material. So that would easily take you a number of years to go through that. All I'm saying is the amount of material that I have out there right now for the general public is more than what most people can absorb. So there's no reason for me to create more material in that direction. So what I have to do now, as far as my time is concerned, which is very valuable and limited, and moving in a number of different directions, what I have to do now is concentrate on what's important, the physical projects that I'm working on, the theoretical work, like the prime number work, which is really advanced at this point. And I'll just tell you a little story. I recently contacted one of the premier people in the world of prime numbers, had a discussion, and literally the person gave up. He couldn't understand it. And that is, it's problematic of academia, let me just put it that way, that people are so locked into their way of their worldview of things, they just don't have a clue of how to step out of that box. They're just molded. And, you know, after decades and decades of doing the same thing and seeing prime numbers in the same light, they just can't step out of that box. And that's why I was able to solve problems that other people could not in relation to prime numbers, is because I can step out of the box. I'm not bound to that that format of thinking that they've been locked into for the last, you know, 150 years collectively in the mathematics world, or longer than that, going back literally thousands of years, where people just couldn't step out of the box and understand things. Okay, so I wanted to spend the first few minutes of this show talking about where things have been. I spent the last 3 weeks talking about the eclipse, and I'll do a little summary on that. But what I wanted to do is kind of bring everything up to date, where we are right now with my understanding of how the universe works, which is very accurate, and also make sure you are aware, and I'll just repeat it once again, where we have tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, tier 4 level of science and of mathematics, the same thing. Tier 1 is military science, and let me give you an example. When my book in 2007 came out, Calculate Prime, showing how to directly calculate prime numbers in groups, something that nobody had ever done before, nobody had ever imagined before. Through the feedback that I got, which was immediate, the military had made use of RSA codes. These are what are known as public key encryption. It's another word for encryption or security of transmitting data. And in 2007, my book that I released basically broke those codes. And remember that I spent 25 years of my life in high-level security positions in telecommunications, working in one of the main fields I was in was encryption, data security, modeling and understanding transmission protocols. I was on the 602 committees for Ethernet, helping design that protocol, and on and on. So it's something I knew about, and it's something, by the way, that I didn't release to the public because the boys, let's put it that way, were constantly after me trying to ruin my reputation and to destroy my life. You know, and what they do is they go after your income. They go after your livelihood. They go after your ability to reach the public. And through all of those decades, I maintained, because these were high security jobs and it was not publicized that I was working at these places. And so anyway, I was able to make a living through all these years because I was able to work on high security in high security positions in telecommunications. But it's something I know a lot about. So when I released that book, I knew that it was going to have a devastating effect on computer security. I actually went to a remote island to release it, where I had special communication equipment, because the whole issue was that the encryption codes were used by the military, they were used in military satellites, they were used in banking, they were used in all kinds of secure computing. And the feedback I got right away was that the military went in and realized what a mess they had, because when you're dealing with software development, in especially for something like the military, it's compartmentalized. So every programmer is doing his little piece of the puzzle, and he doesn't tell everybody where they were using the RSA encryption codes, the public key encryption, the prime numbers, etc. Nobody really knew where these went. So they were in hardware, they were in software, they were in satellites, they were in computing systems, they were in Helicopters, they were in every piece of military equipment you could imagine had these, but nobody knew where they were. So the feedback I got was they were working frantically to put patches and band-aids on all of this. In fact, there was Michael Chertoff, who was the head of Homeland Security at the time in 2007, got up on a podium and he basically publicly stated his exact words where he said, we have an issue with, or this is paraphrased a bit, but he basically said, we have an issue with secure computing. We don't know how bad it is and we don't know how to fix it. And he was referring to my Calculate Primes book, which destroyed the RSA codes, which were used in. And by the way, you have to read my book if you're interested in this topic. It's called Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, where I describe the secure computing industry and how they then went on to continue using RSA codes because all of the NSF and the CIA and all the monitoring that was going on relied on the fact that they could break the RSA codes. And so they couldn't go out and sell the public or businesses encryption codes that worked because the CIA and the FBI couldn't get into them. Okay, so anyway, I described that whole scenario, that big mess, and that's why you're seeing a lot of hacked businesses now is because they're still selling the RSA encryption as some kind of secure computing, which it is not. And so it's a whole corrupt industry. One of the, I wouldn't say, it's hard to say one of the more corrupt industries, but certainly a very corrupt industry selling computer security. Okay, so the reason I'm mentioning that is because they, getting back to the original concept here, that tier one science in engineering, let's put it that way, or mathematics, practical mathematics reacted immediately understanding the issue. And the reason I'm pointing that out is because that information got back to me. I got information directly. I knew people whose, for example, a person I knew, his daughter was in charge of the Navy's work to patch up the public key encryption, the RSA code encryption that was in all of the computer systems and hardware, etc., of the Navy. So they were working feverishly to patch that up. And that information got back to me. Whereas, interestingly enough, to cover this up to the public, there would be shows like, what was that? Like one of those CFI or one of those shows, I forget the exact name of it, where they talked about. You know, it was like these guys supposedly working in intelligence agencies. It was a TV series. And they would just off the cuff say, oh, that's protected by 1024-bit encryption and would take all the computers in the world 50 years to break it. Just trying to keep the public, you know, off guard. And I started seeing that on television shows repeatedly. As a way of kind of reinforcing this public key encryption system, you know, for the public mindset. So it's when you, if you're looking from my perspective, you start to see these kind of things, and not many people on the planet, including people who supposedly know about encryption, you know, university professors or. Or people in the encryption industry really didn't understand what was going on, and those that did covered it up. So at any rate, the reason I'm mentioning this is the reaction of tier one mathematics versus tier two, where they kept selling it, the broken encryption systems. And then, of course, tier three, tier four would be the outreach, which would be television programs. So you really have to understand this tier level of science, mathematics, whatever it is, or geology or archaeology. There are tier one levels, and there are tier two levels, and there are tier three levels, and they all follow the same pattern. Tier two is the garbage, so-called peer-reviewed material that gets pawned off on the public. tier one is a level that you never see. And you have to understand, too, that this is worshipped, this level of science. It's owned and worshipped by the, for example, the Vatican Bank. There's a whole level of secrecy involved in the people that operate that, who operate basically and have for hundreds of years, operate the various governments of the world through the Vatican Bank. Remember, and they would do that by arranging marriages, arranging wars, and arranging governments, arranging elections. And I've said this before, that the CIA is the police force of the World Bank. So you have to understand the world structure to understand who's really running things. And the level of information, that cutoff between Tier 1 and Tier 2, that, in fact, you could talk about government. Tier 1 government is the real government that's running everything, which you never see. And Tier 2 government would be the President of the United States or the President of China. Those people are Tier 2. They don't do anything. That's why Obama could go golf every day, because he really didn't do anything. He didn't decide anything. He was a clog in the wheel. And to imagine that somehow he's in there operating or thinking about things and how to move the country. No. He's off golfing. And he had more golf games than any other president in history. And literally because in the truest sense of the word, he was not president. Somebody else was running the show. He was just the visible, the window dressing to make people think that they elected a president. They didn't elect a president. They haven't elected a president for decades and decades and decades. Okay, so anyway, you have to really understand that to put, for example, my science and work into perspective. Because I don't cater to any of that. I don't cater to, and I can tell you that the Tier 1 scientists know very much, very well, that my work is correct. Okay, so anyway, I just want to summarize where we are today. This is April. Please don't make it August yet. April 11th, 2024. And so, like I say, I'm not going to produce more material dealing with things that I've already dealt with. I'm not going to repeat anything, is what I'm saying. There's enough information out there that if people really want to be a student of this, there's plenty of information. And if you absorb all of that, really, and have a high level of understanding, you've absorbed about 10 to 20% of what I've done. Now in the future, like I say, I'm going to be releasing new material that's plowing new ground as far as the public is concerned. And that deals with things that have not been released before. Okay, so moving along. Now, the other thing about this show is a lot of times I would talk about current events. And I'm going to try to stick to things that are relatively important. One thing that is very important to understand, because of all of the chatter going on now about people going to Mars, right now there's a Humans to Mars conference going on. It's worldwide. It's going to be highly attended, and a lot of hoopla over this humans going to Mars. And one of the forerunners, of course, in this is Elon Musk. He's building rockets, then designing systems that potentially could go to Mars. But I thought it was very interesting seeing a realistic interview with him the other day. And I don't know, I think it was Joe Rogan. I'm not sure. But he said, realistically, what is it going to be like going to Mars? He said, well, a lot of people are going to die. A lot of people are going to, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be extremely difficult. And the risks are going to be very high, because they don't have any way for people to maintain themselves once they get there. And this is what I've said all along, but oddly enough, never ever does he talk about the radiation issue. You see bits and pieces sometimes when NASA's talking about going to Mars, going to the moon. You see just rudimentary bits and pieces about how maybe they've got radiation detectors on the Artemis mission that they send out into above Earth orbit, collect some data, and then bring it back. But the radiation issue is really the big thing, because you're out in open space, and Mars does not have a protective layer, doesn't have an ionosphere, it does not have the ozone layer like Earth has. You are just naked to the radiation of outer space and a lot of X-rays. Now, what's the issue with X-rays and also the solar wind? Well, that's the real damaging part, because the ultraviolet light will be blocked by a spaceship. That'll just relatively easy to block. But the X-rays are not. The other thing is you have high-energy particles, and you have localized discharges that create streams of electrons. And when those electrons hit metal, the high-energy ones especially, they will convert into X-rays. So your dosage of X-rays on any extended space trip would be very high. I saw an article recently where NASA is talking about doing studies on low Earth orbit, especially with tourism coming along. They're going to try and do everything they can to limit tourism in outer space, to just because they want to keep outer space as the private playground for the elite. And, you know, they don't want people being able to pay $100,000 to go into space. They simply don't want that. And so they're going to try and throw every form of roadblock, with the FAA becoming involved, with other, committees to study the safety. And, you know, I've said this before, they don't care about safety of the public. The public does all kinds of things. Why don't they have a regulation of surfboards or skateboards? You find kids out skating around, flying down banisters, you know, potentially super dangerous things where they could fall and crack their head wide open. They don't care about that. You know, if a guy rides a wave in and gets smashed on the surf or under a rock or something, they don't care. There's no federal outcry. A lot more people are surfing than going into space. So why don't they regulate surfing? Because they don't care. They don't care about your safety. They just don't want people going into their little private playground, which is outer space. So anyway, this whole issue of going to Mars. But anyway, I thought it was interesting to see Elon Musk, who's, you know, if there's anybody that could go, it would be Musk and his crew of engineers, because a very capable group of people. But they cannot control things like radiation. There are things, for example, I always talk about this. Say you were going to go camping, you know, and you were going to, you've never been camping before. So you go to the camping store and you buy all the correct things for camping. You got your cook kit, you got your dried food, you got your canteen water bottle, you got your little pills to clean up water so that it's not toxic. You know, drop a pill in and kills bacteria, whatever it is. You got all your stuff, you got your special backpack, you got your hiking boots and socks, and, you know, the mosquito repellent. You got everything you need for going camping. So you go out camping, you got your fire starter, your fire, you know, your little flamethrower to start start fires with. You've done all the best planning possible. And then you go camping and you don't know what to do because you've never been camping before. That's what it's going to be like going to Mars, except exaggerated about 10,000 times, because now you're off in a spaceship all by yourself. The thing about going camping is if you forgot something, well, next time you can go to the store, get it, and maybe you forgot, raincoat. Oh, doggone, it rained. Oh, I didn't know it was going to rain when I was camping. You forgot, okay, now you go back, you buy your raincoat, and you next time you go camping and it rains, you got your raincoat. It's not like that going to Mars. Once you blast off, buddy, and nobody has ever done this before, do you think there's going to be some glitches, that there are going to be people finding this out along the way? Like, just imagine when the people in the covered wagons first started going west across the Great Plains. They didn't even know where they were going to. A lot of them died. It was rough. People were, you know, stories about people eating their belt for nutrition because there was no food. Hey, there was no 7-Eleven along the great wagon routes west. It was pretty brutal. People died. They just walked to death. You know, little kids couldn't make it. They dropped dead along the trail. And going to Mars is going to be a whole lot worse, buddy. You know, once you get there, it's going to be a year and a half until you can come back. That's the earliest window if you got the right amount of fuel. Most fuel containers, if you're looking at the type of fuel that's used for rockets and rocket engines, that fuel doesn't sit in a tank for a year, year and a half. I'm sorry. Sorry to break the news to you, buddy. But that fuel is not going to sit there in a tank for a year and a half. It's probably going to sit there for a few days. You know, so, you know, the number of probable potential flaws in this idea of going to Mars is just utterly fantastic. But you got these people that they're going to their meeting and everybody's going to Mars and they're going to wear their little backpack and they go, you know, like a hike in a national park going to Mars. They're crazy. They're nuts. And you know what? It's like anything else involved in the space program. It's a money maker. How many CEOs of aerospace corporations have been in space? None. Not a single one. Zero. Why? They don't care about going into space. They care about making money, about pretending to go into space. And the longer it takes and the less they do, the more they get. Because, you know, in this ruse that only NASA can do it because it's really difficult, once again, a complete ruse. Because, Earth orbit, lower Earth orbit, is very protected. You don't have the radiation. You have some of the solar conditions, but it's really pretty limited, and they've learned how to control that. But once you get above that, a couple hundred miles off the Earth's surface, things change drastically. The idea that humans to Mars, have a great time at your meeting, you know, everybody goes and gives speeches, you know, everybody's buying for that government money, some kind of piece of the pie to make money off of. And, you know, if you go to Mars, more power to you, but I'll tell you, my guess is that a lot of people are going to die going and never make it back. Their spaceship's not making it back. How many, this is another good analogy with the covered wagons. When the people went west in covered wagons, they got to a certain point and they stayed there. They built a house. They had land. They could grow food. You know, they could develop a life there wherever they ended up, out on the prairie, little house on the prairie type thing. But you go to Mars, sorry, you're not planting a garden. There's no water. There's nothing there for you to develop for food or for sustenance or to make another spacesuit. Nothing. You got to take everything with you, buddy. And the chances of you having everything you need and everything going right, just like the guy that went camping, forgot his rain suit, that's going to happen. And these are going to be critical things. And Elon Musk in this interview said there's a lot of points of failure, and it could be something as simple as like the old mariners not having vitamin C. Because when they originally started doing coastal sailing out from Portugal and Spain and Italy and the northern coastal locations, or the Vikings, even the Vikings went farther than most people. The trips were short, relatively short, and maybe they were on the ocean for a week or two or something like that. But when they got to where they were going, wherever they landed, there was natural sources of food. They could hunt. There was water. There was berries. There was food that they were familiar with to eat, nuts from trees, whatever it was. They had some way of in fishing. because the fish were very plentiful back in those days. So at any rate, they had a way of existing, living off the land, so to speak. But you go to Mars, I'm sorry, there ain't no living off the land. And it could be something as simple, like Musk says, as not having vitamin C on the ocean. And so how did the sailors, that's why they called them limeys, because they would eat limes to get vitamin C. And that was one of the very easy ways to store a portable vitamin C is with limes on the ocean. And that was what you would eat to get vitamin C on a long ocean voyage. Okay, so at any rate, my opinion is, why don't we fix things on planet Earth here? I would think people would be better off concentrating on low Earth orbit, develop space stations in low Earth orbit, and then send robots to Mars until you get the technology. Here's the point. Here's the entire point of going to Mars, is that they have not done in low Earth orbit what they have to do to get to Mars. And so, like the camping example, okay, you bought all your camping gear, you got everything in order. Okay, so let's camp in the backyard for a couple nights. Okay, oops, then you figured out this, you don't have any cooking oil. Oops, we forgot the cooking oil. How do you cook your food without cooking oil? Okay, so now you got to have cooking oil, a little jar of that to take camping, enough to last for the camping trip. And so, okay, so you go camp in the backyard as a little experiment, and you learn about camping. Or you go on a weekend camp trip to the National Park campground, where you got water, you got running water, you got showers, you got a fire pit all built ready for you. You buy your firewood all ready to burn. You just untie the string and you got a bundle of firewood. That's how most people would go camping. They don't go out and forage their wood and cut it and split it. And half the time when you go to the woods camping, the wood is wet. How do you deal with that? And so most people camping, in fact, a lot of people camping is in an RV. They don't really camp. They maybe go out and light a little campfire with wood they bought at the local 7-Eleven store. But that's the closest to real outdoor living they get. That's called camping. And so you see one of these superstores, Camp World, it's all about RVs, a big vehicle that's more comfortable than your living room. Okay, so at any rate, this whole idea of people going to Mars is just a moneymaker. It's just a way for people to make money off of outer space, and that's all outer space has ever been. Let's face it, like I say, how many CEOs of aerospace corporations have ever been in space? None. Show me one, please. Show me one. A real CEO of a real aerospace corporation. They have no interest in going to space. If you came up to one of them and said, hey, why don't you go into space? They'd go, no, it's dangerous. I'm not going there. I'm just making the money off of it. Just one other comment about Mars is that it is very definitely geologically a water planet with recent water. And I talked about this long in my weather book. The entire middle section, 8 pages of my weather book, are high-resolution photographs of the Martian surface, the entire planet. And the reason I did that is because it demonstrates many, many, many different reasons why there is water, all the earmarks of water, recent water on planet Mars. But at any rate, the reason I'm mentioning this is because recently the little Mars rover things up there that they keep sending pictures back, and by the way, that is not the equipment that's really roving around Mars. They have much, much better equipment on Mars, examining, probably looking at ruins that were there, civilizations, because they know that Mars was an occupied planet. And when I say they, I'm talking about the secret societies that run the World Banking Community. This is their religion, is having secret data relative to the past, whether it's Antarctica, whether it's Mars, or other ceremonial sites around the planet. And of course, that's why they're pointing off tier two archaeology on the public, you know, that the somehow man populated the Western Hemisphere by crossing the Bering Strait, complete garbage archaeology. But Mars, every place you look is sedimentary rock, riverbeds, you know, it's everything that a water planet would have, except the water and atmosphere are simply not there anymore because they were removed. When Venus came by, around the best date we have is around 1500 BC. Okay, so anyway, a little bit of a discussion here. And that is the following. This is really important. This has come to my attention, and it's something that I want everybody to listen closely here. I'm going to talk about sediment in water systems, especially municipal water systems. We've always known that when people have private wells, they tend to have a sediment issue. The water coming up from the well has sediment, sometimes gritty sediment, sometimes superfine sediment, sometimes high mineral content, but some kind of sediment in the water. And there's a number of ways of getting rid of that. You can have a pre-filter, like, say, a Big Blue, the kind we sell on the JMCC Water Filters webpage. Or you can do the following, which is something that I do when I'm in a remote location and I have a gravity water filter as my water source. You take the water and you put it in another container of some kind, or you have a special container just for this, and then you let the water sit for, you know, minimum 6 hours. And usually about 95% of the sediment drops out in the first 5 minutes. But it's that super fine sediment that takes time to, like, drop down. It does so very slowly, so that's why you wait 6 hours or so or more. And then you scoop out very gently, you scoop out that water into your water filter if you have a gravity water filter. Something has come up here that makes this even more important to do. And so here's the problem, and especially with the old-style water filters that stick up in the upper container. They will trap part of that sediment material, and part of it will just pass through. So you're getting that. In fact, I had a guy call up this week, and he said, your filters are getting plugged up. And I said, yeah, that's because there's they're working. They're taking something out of the water that your other filters didn't take out. But anyway, that's one issue, just the sediment issue. And that person had a well. So I said, you have to take the water, put it in another container, let it set and let the sediment drop out, and then put it into your filter. And here's the issue with filters that stick up into the upper container. Once the water level starts to drop in your upper container, in your gravity filter, it starts to drop down below the top of the filter. Well, guess what? The top of the filter isn't doing anything anymore because there's no water there. And as the water level drops, it turns out that about 80% of your water is filtered through the bottom 2 inches of that upright standing filter element. And so that's, you know, most of your water is filtered through about 20% of your water filter. So that creates a little bit of a problem. Because most of your filter is not being used at all. Okay, that's one issue. That's just a physical issue. That's just an issue with sediment. But here's what's going on, and I found out about this because we're getting more and more reports of sediment in city water. Here is the problem. That is a delivery mechanism for viruses and bacteria. And so here's what happens. Bacteria and viruses typically don't stand alone. They attach to something. They attach to a piece of grit, a piece of sediment, a piece of something in the water. And so what happens if you have that vertical water filter sticking up in the upper tank? Part of the sediment is being trapped on the outside of the filter. Okay, Some of it is passing through because the pore size is pretty big on those filters. And so you have potential right there for the viruses and bacteria that are attached to that sediment to just pass right through your filter and go into your water supply, and then you have bacteria and water, potentially viruses in your water supply. Secondly, what happens is if you let that sediment sit there on the surface of that filter, then what's going to happen is eventually that virus or bacteria is going to break free because of the natural flow of the water through the filter. Those viruses and bacteria are going to break free and they're going to flow right through that filter into your water supply. That's why you have to get the sediment out of your water before you put it into your gravity water filter. Now, the MR5 whole house water filter doesn't have that issue because if you have a sediment problem, then you would use like the Big Blue inline filter first. And then the MR5 has a 0.1 micron filter, physical filter stage one. And then if anything gets through there, you have the UV sterilizer, which zaps everything, kills any kind of living organism in the last stage. So you don't have that issue with the MR5 whole house water filter, but you do with gravity water filters. And really, I'm telling people, if money is tight and you can only afford replacement filter elements for your gravity water filter, then get that. But in the long run, it's going to cost you the same amount of money for filters, the filter element replacement elements for a gravity filter system as it would for the MR5, because the MR5 filters you replace every 55,000 gallons, whereas the gravity filter elements you replace every 1,000 gallons. And there's some of these wild claims. People go, oh, 6,000 gallons for a water filter. No, for these little gravity feed water filters, 1,000 gallons is max. I used to sell various brands and types of those, and I don't anymore. I just sell my own brand right now. But 1,000 gallons for a little filter element is max, because the problem is the medium, which, if it even has it, the medium which removes the toxins that are in solution is very limited. That's where your problem is. That's where your limitation is. Okay, so at any rate, what I'm telling people is if you use a gravity filter, and a lot of people do, millions and millions of them out there, and I still sell a lot of the gravity water filter elements that replace, all the different makes and models, you have to get that sediment out of the water before you put it into your gravity water filter. Otherwise, you run the risk of viruses and bacteria. Now I'm going to explain a little more. And if you're a little queasy, you may not want to listen to the following. There is more and more fecal matter, that means human poop, that's the word in general terms, fecal matter in the water supplies, both in well water and especially in city water, where they are recycling the water. And when I used to go to college, a little kind of humor here, I went to college in a river town. It was on the Mississippi River, and somebody would write on the wall of the bathroom, would say, "Flush twice, it's a long way to St. Louis," or something, or "No, a long way to New Orleans," or something like that, and meaning that the waste from this little town would go into the river, and it would go all the way down the river, and somebody else was getting the water from your sewage in their water supply. And it was really true. The farther down the river you got, the more polluted the water was with agricultural runoff, with pollution, with human waste and everything. But now, especially in big cities, there are many big cities right now in the United States, and more municipalities starting to use recycled water, is what they call it, is the water that went through the sewage system. They're putting it back into the city water system. If that's not enough to make you kind of like plug your nose, or anyway, but that's going on. So you have more and more fecal matter in the water, on which bacteria and viruses can grow. And of course, they will poison the water with chlorine, hoping to kill all of that, but the reality is it does not. With the more and more water and more usage of water and the lower level of water in the storage tanks, you're getting more and more bacteria and virus, potentially viruses, and other things like pharmaceuticals, all of the pharmaceuticals that people take, and that goes into the wastewater. That's not being cleaned up. That's not eliminated. There's no filtration of any of this. So all of that's going into your water. And much of that attaches to sediment. A lot of this other material that's in solution collects and attaches to sediment. That's why it's important to get sediment out of your water before you put it into your gravity water filter. So I'm talking to people, and I'm of the opinion of being in the water filter business that you should not be using gravity water filters anymore. But if that's all you got, that's okay. That's it. That's all you can afford. Okay, that's certainly better than nothing. Okay, so enough of that, but I wanted to make this clear because this is a topic. Last week I was on Jeff Rentz's show. I talked about this specific topic about the increasing amount of materials, pharmaceuticals, heavy metals, bacteria, and viruses that are in the water system that are going to attach to chunks of stuff, sediment, basically sediment. And if you leave that in your water, as it goes into your water filter, it's going to accumulate, and that bacteria and virus material that's growing in there is going to pass through your filter and get into your water system. It's as simple as that. So you have to get that sediment out of your water before you put it into your water filter. It's simple as that. And the other thing about my filter elements, the gravity ones, is that they have a 0.01 micron pore size in the pre-filter, the stage one filter. And so that is small enough to where it actually can remove viruses from the water. But the biggest portion of that is going to be removed when you get that sediment out of your water, because viruses just don't live and hang out in free water. They are generally attached to something. And that's once again why you want to get the sediment out of your water. Okay, enough of that. On to the next topic. Okay, now here's a story that just kind of made me cringe. And this is scary stuff. This is the stuff that fascism is made of. There was a group of 2,000 women that won a landmark lawsuit against the country of Switzerland, claiming that the government of Switzerland had not done enough to prevent climate change, and that it affected the livelihood and the well-being of these 2,000 women, and they appeared to be of all ages, young, old, etc. And of course, they're coming into court with a club, basically this idea of climate change. But the court, what's interesting, is they didn't have to prove the case of climate change. It was assumed. It was assumed that there is an issue relative to climate change that's directly affecting their lives. And so they won and this is a verdict which is non-challengeable, if you can imagine that. So what's the problem here? Well, the problem is that climate change, is, in its very broad sense, is an just unproven science. In science, let's say you're measuring the speed of an automobile from 0 to 60 in so many seconds. That's a measurable meta. That's something that you can measure with a stopwatch, with people there. You can have cameras at the finish line. It's measurable. Climate change is this vague term that does not have measurables, and the reason is because there are millions of factors that lead to the changes in climate, the cooling, the heating, the heat content, and there's literally thousands, tens of thousands of scientists that are coming out now signing petitions that climate change is a hoax. And so anyway, but the whole point of this legal action is it makes the assumption that there's some kind of science at the basis of this, and that somehow is related to the well-being of these 2,000 women. Now, if you believe in climate change, how does it measurably affect these women, and how can the court system make a determination of cause and effect? That's where things start to get strange. And so the question is, where are the measurables here in both the edict that climate change affects the planet at all, and secondly, that it affects the people's well-being? Well, certainly their mental well-being, because mentally they think there's an effect here. But there's a whole nother large group of people that would say that that's bogus science, that it doesn't exist. It's certainly, and people will say, well, there's a major agreement amongst scientists of the world that global climate change is real. No, that's not true. It's just simply that if you want to get grant money in the woke, grant system, then you need to come up with results relative to climate change. And if you do, you get more grant money. If you don't, then you're out of a job and you're not there to be counted. Okay, so at any rate, just a very strange result. Like I say, that's so-called using science, but there are no measurables. There are no physical measurables. If you go with a rocket into outer space, into low Earth orbit, there's a measurable. You can see it. You can measure it. And there's all kinds of fallacies in the whole global climate change issue. They're talking about temperature increases, and I've talked about this before, that it's they're using in the double use of different terms, because what they really mean is that there's increased amount of heat in the atmosphere, which does not necessarily result in increased temperature. But on the other hand, if you're wondering what the situation really is, there's far more heat being dumped into the atmosphere in direct atmospheric heating than ever will occur with global climate change. So we have to stop burning nuclear fuel. We have to stop burning coal and carbon-based materials, and they are not fossil fuels, by the way. We have to just stop doing that. Wind does not create extra heat. You're changing the wind into electric energy, and typically most of that returns back in the form of wind once it's used. Okay, so enough of that, but remember, go to my web pages, jmccsci.com. That's the main page, the water filter page, jmccwaterfilters.com. There's a sale right now on the MR5. And remember, this is a commercial-free show. And once again, this is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.